This is Publishing Talks, a podcast about the publishing industry. I'm David Wilk, your host. Today I'm talking to Ron Hogan, who's currently the Director of E-Marketing Strategies for Harcourt Houghton Mifflin, based in New York City. Hi, Ron. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. Thank you.
Well, it's good to talk to you today. I know this is a fairly new job for you. Maybe you could talk a little bit about your history in the book business or history in general and how you got here.
Absolutely. I started in the book business when I was in graduate school at the University of Southern California in the mid-90s, and I had a part-time job at Dudden's Brentwood Books in West Los Angeles. Really great independent bookstore, and I was working there a couple days a week. And then suddenly I wasn't in grad school anymore, and Doug Dudden, the owner, was kind enough to give me a few more days a week to be working with the books, and that was going really well. And it was also right around the time that the World Wide Web was starting to take off. There was the first article in Wired magazine about this new program called Netscape and web pages, and I was like, oh, that sounds interesting. I think I want to get in on that. And then I'm like, well, what am I going to do a web page about? And then it dawns on me that authors are coming through on their book tours, the Dudden's, all the time. And so I started doing Q&As with authors for the website, which was called Beatrice.com. And that launched, I guess, in 1995, early 95.
Was Beatrice in that connection? Is that Dante's Beatrice?
I like to tell people that, but it was actually, you know, this was 95 and hardly anybody had domain names. So there was another article in Wired about this enterprising fellow who had bought McDonald's.com and then sold it to McDonald's for, you know, not a princely sum, but a decent sum, a couple thousand dollars. And I figured, okay, Beatrice Foods, that would be a good one. And it's not like, you know, I never went to Beatrice Foods and said, hey, I have your domain name, because, you know, that would be gauche. But I did figure that, you know, Beatrice was a lovely name for a website, and this was also when Yahoo was really ascendant rather than Google. And if you remember the big deal about Yahoo, it's that it was an alphabetical directory of the web. And so naming your site Beatrice also meant you were pretty high up on the hierarchy. So these were all, you know, good reasons in and of themselves to name the site Beatrice. And then if they ever came to me and said, you know, we're thinking about doing a website, and we notice you own the domain name, we would like to buy that off of you, I would be willing to consider that offer.
So did that happen?
They never came to me. I think they went straight to BeatriceFoods.com.
And what became of Beatrice then?
The conglomerate actually got bought up by another conglomerate, and I think the brand name is floating around somewhere in Asia. They don't actually use it very much as an American brand anymore.
So what happened to Beatrice.com?
So Beatrice.com continues to stay up and running. I used it as an outlet for literary pursuits as I was transitioning from working at Dudden's to doing more freelance web work, because, you know, dot-coms were taking their time developing. And I eventually moved from Los Angeles to San Francisco to get in on the ground floor of what we used to call new media. And I spent about 2 years in San Francisco working for websites there, and then eventually was hired by Amazon.com for a position that they called section editor, which in retrospect was more kind of a copywriting sort of position. Basically, I was in charge of the politics, current events section, and for a time, the history section as well. And this was at a time when they had a staff of 20 people whose job it was to manage each of those sections, choose which books got featured, and at a time when Amazon was really writing a lot of its own reviews, to make sure that the top books in each field were reviewed every month. So I was responsible through my own writing and through hiring freelancers for making sure that about 70 to 80 books got reviewed a month on the site.
And what'd you do after that?
And after that, that lasted about 2 years. And then in early 2000, Amazon sort of realized that they were paying 20 people full-time salaries to administer reviews that customers were increasingly willing to write for free. So they laid off a portion of the department. And I had been doing Beatrice on my own you know, as a side project this whole time. Because my job at Amazon was strictly nonfiction, I was able to keep Beatrice as an outlet for me to write about fiction authors. And so I went back to that. And I also knew that I wanted to continue working in the intersection of books and the internet. And it seemed like New York was the best place to come for that. So I came to New York in the summer of 2000, freelanced for a number of years, eventually switched to a blog format for Beatrice in 2003, which actually ended up making the site more popular than it had ever been because daily updates were more accessible than the one or two times a month that I had been updating before.
And did you do all the writing for Beatrice yourself?
Initially, I did. There was a phase where, after I had been doing Beatrice as a blog for a while, MediaBistro.com hired me to revamp their publishing industry news blog, Gallycat. And my workload on that was such that I really was not having a lot of time to spend on Beatrice. So I began to increasingly rely on a technique that I had started using, I think, around the holiday season, my first time that I had been doing the blog, which was to invite guest authors to participate and to write short essays about books that they were recommending or inspirations or things like that. So while I was at Gallycat, that was sort of the primary mode that Beatrice was operating under. I also, for a brief time, had four up-and-coming book bloggers who were contributing spot items to Beatrice in exchange for the exposure to their own blogs that, that being on Beatrice would give them. And then in recent months, as the position at Gallycat ended and I've come over here, I've sort of taken over Beatrice back full for myself. And although there is still a lot of guest writers, people who are promoting their new books by writing essays about their inspirations, I do write a lot more for Beatrice than I have in recent years, probably, you know, close to as much as I did when it was first a blog.
So you've been involved in this for quite a long time. I mean, this meaning, as you call it, the intersection of books and the internet. And now you're involved in marketing, which is, you know, maybe a formalization of what you've learned over the course of the last 15 years. And I guess I'm, you know, without necessarily talking about the things that you're doing here, because I think it, you know, that's sort of specific to your role.
And they are all proprietary trade secrets.
Exactly. we don't want to give away the trade secrets. But I am interested in talking to you about where the this intersection of books and the web is going and how it's – and it's changing rapidly all the time. There's so many interesting things going on. You know, one of the questions I have, of course, is – for any author, and I think this applies to publishers, of course, as well, how do you get noticed on the web? You know, how do you stand out from, if we want to look at it as this massive ocean or the river, you know, the Amazon reference, the metaphor of the river is a good one. You know, there's so many books being published. There's so many voices being heard. How does one engage an audience?
Yeah. Well, I mean, when I converted to a blog format, I came up with like a subheader for the masthead. And sort of the tagline that I used to describe Beatrice was introducing readers to writers since 1995. And I think that's basically a big part of, you know, what book marketing is, online or otherwise. It's introducing readers to writers. And, you know, whether I'm doing that by hand-selling a book in a bookstore or writing a book review for a magazine or, you know, writing a post on my blog, it's all about putting that connection together to put the book into somebody's frame of reference and say, you know, this is something that I think would be of interest to you. You should check it out. And hopefully sparking that connection.
Right, which is very much, I think, a bookseller's impulse. Mm-hmm. In other words, the notion of connecting a reader to a book is a kind of retail event.
Yeah, but it's also, I think, a book lover's experience, too. I mean, you know, from the time that you're a child, or maybe more from the time that you're an adolescent, I think, and, you know, one of the ways that we socialize with each other, and one of the things that we really enjoy doing from that age onward is, you know, if you what do you do when you read a really great book and you close it and you love it? You immediately go and try to put it into somebody else's exactly hands right. and say, I loved this book. You should read it. So, I mean, there's a retail component to it once you get into the field of commerce. But I think it's fundamentally a much more social and a much more almost intimate sort of connection right. or exchange.
Well, I meant that in a sort of generic retail sense. In other words, not even – it's about connecting to a reader in a kind of one-to-one way.
Absolutely.
Ultimately. Mm-hmm. And that's a difficulty for a lot of publishers who have been, to use a really old web term, intermediated through many years of being essentially a manufacturer talking to – middle people, either retailers or wholesalers.
Right. Yeah. There is this conception that for the longest time, the primary relationship that publishers as an institution nurtured or fostered was that relationship with the retailers, where they made sure that the books were featured or prominently displayed in the bookstores, that stock was always on hand. And then it was the bookseller's job, as you framed the experience, to engage the readers. There were certainly exceptions to that. You know, the most prominent that I can think of is, say, Harlequin, which did a fantastic job of forging a direct connection with readers even before there were any of these social networking tools. I mean, when media was largely, like, you know, one way, and consumers were primarily receivers rather than distributors, romance readers still knew that if they wanted, you know, really good romance, consistent romance, they should look for the Harlequin label. And
right.
and so they would go to the store and there would be that Harlequin display right there for them.
Right, or Rodale would be another publisher.
Mm-hmm. Or Rodale in the realm of health, Del Rey in the realm of science fiction, yeah, certain children's imprints, I think, in that realm. Whereas larger publishers, simply by virtue of publishing a wide variety of books on a wide variety of subjects, both fiction and nonfiction, have sometimes had a harder time establishing that kind of identity with which readers have been easily able to identify. It's actually been a much easier task for authors to do that. In the sort of sense of, you know, what Foucault actually used to call the author function, you know, what an author's name sort of stands for, you know, in the sense that it's like, you know what Stephen King stands for, you know what James Patterson stands for, you know, on a level you even know what, say, a historian like Edmund Morris stands for if you're buying that book, or, you know, to name one of our authors, Philip Roth. Or,
sure.
or James Carroll.
Right, the author in that sense has a brand, which and readers care about the author's brand much more usually than they care about the publisher's brand.
Mm-hmm.
But also authors have this wonderful contradiction, and that is, and I always think of it this way, that when you write, you are talking to yourself in some literal way.
Mm-hmm.
It's between you and the page, or as now, the you and the screen.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to turn from that to the mode of working with an editor and the working with the machinery of publishing, ultimately to talk to an individual reader, which is the goal of every writer. And so the writer's job is very complex. It's not a simple, oh, I write this and then I turn around and I hand it to you, my reader.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, there's that very sort of artisan conception of what it is the author does, that, you know, you toil over the art and then deliver it and voila. But as an author myself, I've kind of come to realize that the metaphor that really makes a little bit more sense, at least for me, is to look at it as a small business, as much as it is an artistic endeavor. That and this is, again, where the marketing element comes into play, is that if you are an author, as you say, you're not just creating for yourself, although fundamentally on a aesthetic, philosophical level, you know, if you're not creating for yourself, there's a problem there. But you do want to be read. And so you do have to take into consideration all these aspects beyond the actual, you know, production of the manuscript that will become the finished book. You really do have to think carefully about how that book will be received and how it will be published, and then how you will go about getting it into people's hands. And I think for a long time, the majority of authors, maybe there was this attitude that, oh, the publisher will take care of that for us. And some publishers encourage that more than others, perhaps. But I think we really are sort of at a point now where that particular illusion, for most authors, there are some authors who are able to do that and to function on that level. But I think most authors do have to go out there and hawk the wares, so to speak. Not in as crass a way as hawk the wares makes it sound, but they do have to go out there. And the internet actually gives them, I think, a really powerful opportunity to do that themselves in a direct way that, you know, for the longest time was basically only possible by, say, you know, loading up the trunk of your car and driving around from bookstore to bookstore, you know, trying to hand sell the book yourself.
Right. Well, and I think, you know, maybe the analog in the analog period was going and doing events in stores. That, you know, if you look back to the 70s and 80s, that became a period when bookstores and publishers introduced readers to authors directly in personal, through personal contact. You would do a reading, a couple of hundred people would show up, and they would get to participate in the artistic experience in a different way. Mm-hmm. And reading is fine. I mean, there's nothing wrong with just reading a book. You don't have to meet the author to have a great experience, but it does, in our modern society, those events helped, I think. Now, the web essentially stands in for that. You know, if you think about it, your analogy of the getting in a car and driving around with books in the back of your car, that's what authors are going to do now on the web. But, of course, the difficulty is we've all learned how to drive a car. The roads are all clearly marked, and there are bookstores when you get to a town who will call on consumers, readers, to come in and let's have a party.
And it's bumper-to-bumper traffic all along the highway.
Right. There are people you know. You can even wave at some of the people you know as you drive by. But on the web, it's still something of an unmarked highway or an unmarked terrain where highways go in all directions at all times. If I was thinking about the Fifth Element, where there's the three-dimensional traffic, you drive both horizontally and vertically at the same time. The web is sort of like that for a lot of people. It's confusing and not clear. So I guess one of the questions I would ask you is, if you were giving advice to an author today, let's assume a range of skill sets, what should authors do today to be part of that conversation with readers?
Okay, well, I think the first thing that I would do if I was an author, which I am actually, is, you know, go out and buy a domain name. Basically yourname.com. And if for some reason somebody else with your name has snagged that and it's not available, as it happens to me actually, another Ron Hogan sort of beat me to the punch there. And I had actually gone to him and I had seen there wasn't a website, ronhogan.com, just that the domain name was tied up. So I asked him, I said, you know, look, I have plans. I've got a book coming out. And, you know, do you have plans for the website? And he had said, yes, I do. You know, sorry. So I ended up getting ronhogan.net, which is a perfectly useful alternative, particularly if you're putting it on the back of your book. But, you know, having that domain name sewed up and putting a website together so that I think what you want to have in place is a situation such that when somebody hears about you for the first time and then goes to Google or one of the other search engines and types in your name, you want the first thing that pops up for them to be a message that you are in control of. You know, which would you rather have when somebody types in your name? You know, yourname.com or a review of your book that somebody really hated, or, you know, the Amazon page with a bunch of customer reviews that, again, you have no control of. And, you know, apart from that, actually, I would say the Amazon page probably isn't that bad a thing to have pop up, because then, of course, somebody can go right there and buy it. But, you know, again, it's a question of, as the author, you want to be in control of your public image to as much a degree as you can. And establishing some sort of web page, even if it's just a simple landing page that says, this is who I am, quick biography, these are my books, available at fine bookstores everywhere. You know, to have that much control over your message is, you know, it's that much more than you have when you don't do anything.
So, but do you think that authors, on top of that, then need, do they need to become marketers on some level, so that they can have some traffic go to the website? Or maybe that doesn't matter. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I think that, you know, you basically, you get out of it what you put into it. So, you know, if you just want to have that generic landing page such that if somebody stumbles upon it, fine. You know, basically what's going to happen is that it will primarily be viewed when somebody stumbles upon it. If you do want to have people visiting that page regularly, you do have to do things with it regularly. And that can be, you know, something as simple as, say, a monthly news bulletin, or as elaborate as a daily blog, sometimes even more than once a day if you have that much more to say. The thing is that you don't do a blog simply because your agent or your publicist says, hey, everybody's out there promoting their books with blogs nowadays, you'd better go out and blog about the book. You know, this is absolutely the worst reason to start a blog. I always use the analogy of that scene in A Christmas Story where Ralphie gets his little orphan Annie decoder ring, and he translates the secret message at the end of the show, and it says, buy more Ovaltine. And he's like, you know, a crummy commercial, and he automatically rejects it and pushes it away. That is, I think, how people online sort of view those kinds of like fake attempts to be, you know, to be sincere that turn out to be nothing more than pitches. And that doesn't mean that you can't pitch yourself and your book, but you have to go about it in a different way. Basically, what I tell people is that if you're out there blogging every day, it's because you are both passionate and authoritative in the sense that you've spent a lot of time thinking about this and writing about it, about whatever subject it is that you're passionately authoritative about. And so you blog about it because you can't imagine not writing about it. This is something that you absolutely, you know, are compelled to share with the world on a regular basis. And so people pick up, what people are picking up on is the passion and the depth and the breadth of your interest in this field and your authority, your knowledge about it. But more so the passion, I think, you know, the fact that this is something that you are deeply, deeply engaged with. And they come to recognize you as a fascinating person through your blog. Now, then you happen to be a fascinating person who has a book out. And if you are an interesting and engaging enough person, or the subject is engaging, you know, enough to a reader, and there's a book attached to it, then it becomes a question of, oh, you know, I already enjoy reading this blog. I'm already interested in what this person has to say about this subject. Let's, you know, pony up and see if the book's any good.
Right. It's sort of an equivalent, again, in that, in the old days, if you published a short story in a magazine, it was a way for people to learn how good you were, so that when you eventually either published a collection of stories or you published your novel, you had people who knew who you were. So it's a similar sort of idea, that you're trying to introduce yourself to people, but not simply saying, here I am, aren't I the greatest? Or, you know, as the WordPress default is, you know, welcome or you know, hello world. Right. It's essentially, you've got to do more. You've got to contribute. And as I think you may have said this, or other people have certainly said it, you get out as much as you're willing to put in. Mm-hmm. That you have to invest.
Right. I mean, you know, you look at somebody like Gary Vaynerchuk, who has become phenomenally successful in the last year or two, basically because he lives and breathes this kind of way of promoting himself. And it's funny. I was at an ebook summit that Media Bistro did in late 2009, and they were talking about authors and promotion. And this woman in the audience got up and said, you know, it's all fine to talk about Gary Vee and all, but, you know, Gary Vee spends hours a day, you know, doing this. And that's the only reason he's famous, is because he spends hours a day doing this. And, you know, what if I don't want to spend those hours a day? And I'm sitting, you know, a few rows behind her. And I don't say this out loud, but I do think to myself, it's like, well, then you don't get to be as famous as Gary.
That's exactly right. No, I think that's a good point. Mm-hmm. That I think I was in the room actually when that was said, and I noticed, I felt the same way, that it really, the web is complicated and busy. If you want to participate, it's like being in a party. If you mm-hmm. if you're talking and you have something really good to say, more people will listen to you. Mm-hmm. If you never speak up, then you won't be heard.
Yeah.
But of course, there are some people who don't want to spend that time, and that's not their interest. And then they'll just have to do it a different way.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Ron. It's been a pleasure, and I really enjoyed talking to you.
Okay.
This is David Wilk for Publishing Talks. I've been talking to Ron Hogan, who is now at Harcourt Houghton Mifflin, but also runs Beatrice.com, which is a website I'd highly recommend. Thank you very much.